It's 6 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Steve Norman reporting. 2 years after the Islamist militants Boko Haram kidnapped more than 200 schoolgirls in northern Nigeria, a new video purporting to show the girls has been giving parents hope their children are still alive. Esther Yakuba is the mother of one of the girls kidnapped in the community of Chibok.
I saw our girls, and through the Chibok girls, I recognize some of them because we are in the same area with them. So I recognize them. They are the Chibok girls.
Did you see your daughter among them?
My daughter is not among them.
Until now, there has been almost no news on the 219 girls taken by Boko Haram in 2014, which sparked global condemnation. North Korea appears to have failed in an attempt to launch a missile to mark the birthday of its founding president. Observers have been anticipating that North Korea would mark the birthday of President Kim Il-sung with the launch of a mid-range ballistic missile. Strong magnitude 6.2 earthquake has shaken southwestern Japan, killing at least nine, injuring hundreds more. Quake was centered about 1,300 kilometers south of Tokyo. It struck the late evening on Thursday when many people were at home. Police say at least 19 houses collapsed and fear many more people could be trapped in the wreckage. Keith Ellison, a Muslim American congressman, is calling Islamic State militants a collection of liars, murderers, torturers, and rapists after the group threatened to kill him. Ellison says no Muslim he knows recognizes the kind of Islam IS preaches. Islamic State issued death threats this week against a number of people it calls politically active apostates in the United States, Australia, Britain, and Canada. This is VOA News. U.S. Defense Chief Ash Carter is visiting the ship the USS John C. Stennis today, which is deployed in the South China Sea, a trip which was likely will anger China. Carter announced the visit today earlier at Manila in the closing ceremonies of the U.S.-Philippines joint military exercises. China claims almost the entire South China Sea and has aggressively carried out island building and patrols in the waters that are claimed by other countries. U.S. military has been conducting joint patrols in the South China Sea with the Philippines and is increasing its presence there. The Sankat-ranking official of the World Bank says the Panama Papers revelations are damaging the public trust and making ordinary citizens more reluctant to pay taxes needed to fund roads and schools and other government functions. We get more now from VOA's Jim Randall.
Papers leaked from a law firm based in Panama show efforts by wealthy people around the world to hide money and avoid taxes. While much of this activity is not illegal, some policymakers in the United States and elsewhere say perhaps it should be. And many are calling for new, tougher laws that make it harder to hide wealth. They argue that when elite people can avoid taxes, ordinary people think they're being treated unfairly. The managing director of the World Bank says that perception damages trust, which can hurt economic growth in countries that badly need it. An investigative journalist with the international group that published stories based on the Panama Papers says they show hundreds of thousands of companies have been created in ways that hide their real ownership and make it hard for officials to track wealth and tax evasion. Jim Randall, VOA News, Washington.
In U.S. politics, Democratic presidential candidates Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders and former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton held a contentious debate Thursday night in a familiar territory, Brooklyn, New York, ahead of next Tuesday's very important New York primary. Christopher Farsee, a Syracuse University political scientist, spoke with VOA about the tone of the debate.
When it comes to the tone of the debate, it was aggressive. Loud, there were sarcasm. So if you didn't know it was in New York, you could kind of tell from the tone.
Both candidates have deep ties to New York. Sanders was born in Brooklyn 74 years ago, and Clinton represented the state as a U.S. Senator from 2001 until 2009. Both candidates have large followings in New York, but polls going into Thursday night's debate show Clinton with a double-digit lead over Sanders statewide. Amanda Bennett, a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist and author, has been chosen as the new director of The Voice of America. She will be sworn in on Monday at VOA headquarters here in Washington. Get more news at our website. You can find us at voanews.com.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Friday, April 15th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. U.S. authorities give details about the arrest of a former Liberian rebel commander.
Jungle Jabba, as he was known, engaged in horrific acts against civilians in Liberia, and he failed to disclose that information to U.S. officials when he applied for admittance into the United States.
That's U.S. Attorney Zane David Meminger of the Eastern District of Pennsylvania. Disagreements linger with just days to go before Monday's arrival of South Sudan rebel leader Riek Machar. The African Union says Sunday's Chad election was credible, but the opposition claims irregularities. And Zimbabwe's opposition leader calls on President Robert Mugabe to retire.
The 2 million jobs that we were promised is now turned out to be 2 million vendors. Mugabe is no solution to the crisis because he's too tired. We are demanding a dignified exit for a tired Mugabe.
That's Zimbabwe former Prime Minister and opposition leader Morgan Tsvangirai. Protesters march in Nigeria's capital on the second anniversary of the Chibok girls' abduction. And the World Bank is concerned over weak global economic growth. Those stories, plus Mark Oldman's sports and our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. U.S. authorities have been given details about the arrest of a former Liberian rebel commander. 49-year-old Mohamed Jabater, also known as Jungle Jabba, was arrested this week at his home in Philadelphia following an investigation by U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement. He served in the 1990s as a commander in the Liberian rebel group United Liberation Movement for Democracy in Liberia, ULIMO, later called ULIMO K. An indictment said Jungle Jabba either personally committed or ordered ULIMO troops under his command to commit numerous heinous crimes. Zane David Meminger, U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of Pennsylvania, says Mohamed Jabater lied twice on two application forms that he was a member of a rebel movement or that he engaged in genocide.
When we admit people into the United States, we don't want people who have engaged in war crimes. And the fact is, as alleged in the indictment, is that Jungle Jabba, as he was known, engaged in horrific acts against civilians in Liberia. And he failed to disclose that information to U.S. officials when he applied for admittance into the United States and sought permanent residency in the United States. Our laws take those disclosure requirements very seriously, and individuals who fail to comply with those disclosure requirements face criminal prosecution, and ultimately, if convicted, possible prison sentences, and additionally face possible deportation from the United States for engaging in that conduct.
So how long has this Mr. Jabater or Jungle Jabba, how long has he been in the United States? And as I was going through the press release, why did it take almost 17 years to apprehend him?
Right. Well, with regard to the United States, how long he's been here, it's been about 18 years. In terms of why it took so long, there are a variety of reasons why matters can take a while to get charged here in the United States. We can't proceed with cases unless we get information that the government can rely on to investigate. That is what happened here. I believe you also had the press release from Homeland Security. And in that regard, with regard to potential victims, our case is ongoing. So to the extent that there's information that people in Liberia may have, or other persons who may be hearing this broadcast may have, it would be useful for them to reach out to federal authorities here in the United States to provide that information so that we can pursue those leads as well.
I was going to ask that particular question. Are you getting any help from Liberians here in the United States in your effort?
I'm not in a position to disclose who may or may not have contacted us. The reality is with regard to investigations such as this, or investigations that we generally do here in the United States, there are issues with regard to witnesses, their privacy, their security. We need to make sure that we're taking all steps to protect them so that we can pursue our cases and make sure that justice is done.
So are you currently investigating other Liberians here in the United States for possible war crimes?
I can't disclose whether or not we're doing that or not. that was probably a better question directed towards the Department of Homeland Security.
So what is the possible sentence, assuming Mr. Jabateh or this Jongo Jaba is found guilty?
He's facing a maximum sentence of 30 years in prison.
Is there any monetary penalty that would be associated with his punishment?
There's the possibility of fines. Generally, the fines for felony conviction are $250,000 per count. And additionally, there's what is known as a special assessment, which is $100 per count. In this case, it would be $400 total because he's charged with four counts, two with regard to the documents and two with regard to the lies to immigration officials.
So when is he due in court?
On Monday, he will be appearing in court for a detention hearing. And at the detention hearing, we will seek to have him detained.
Thank you very much. It's so nice to talk with you.
Pleasure talking with you as well.
Zane David Memminger is the U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of Pennsylvania. He was speaking with me from Philadelphia. Opposition politicians in Chad have claimed fraud during Sunday's presidential election, but African Union observers say the poll, while flawed, was fair. Moki Edwin Kinzeka has more for VOA from N'Djamena.
African Union observers of Chad's presidential election say despite irregularities, overall Sunday's vote was peaceful and credible. Former Malian president and head of the AU observer mission to Chad, Dion Kunda Traore, said issues included the late opening of polling stations in hard-to-access areas and poorly trained polling officers.
Nous n'avons pas d'appréhension particulière par rapport à ce qui va se passer après.
He says they don't know what will happen after the proclamation of the results, but the AU is urging all candidates and their followers to accept the verdict. He says those who are not satisfied with the results should contest them in the courts. Kamalo Salifu Turabi leads the Pan-African Institute for Election Assistance Observer Mission.
Nous avons évalué les indicateurs possibles.
He says despite irregularities, voter participation is estimated at 85%. The opposition says there was fraud, including ballot stuffing. Chadian President Idris Deby is widely expected to win a fifth term in office. The country faces continued threats from the Nigerian terror group Boko Haram. Social issues like the high cost of living sparked unprecedented protests in the run-up to the poll. Five rights activists have been in jail for the last 3 weeks. The Electoral Commission has 2 weeks from the April 10 vote to declare results. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, N'Djamena.
Former Zimbabwe Prime Minister Morgan Tsvangirai on Thursday led thousands of his Movement for Democratic Change supporters in street protests demanding an explanation to the missing $15 billion diamond proceeds and an end to rising poverty and unemployment. Thomas Chiripasi has details from Harare.
Thousands of MDCT supporters gathered at an open space near ZANU-PF headquarters that the opposition has dubbed Freedom Square before Tsvangirai, his wife Elizabeth, and the top MDC brass led them through the Central Business District to Africa Unity Square adjacent to Parliament. The placard-carrying protesters sang revolutionary songs as they marched through Robert Mugabe Way and headed to Africa Unity Square where Tsvangirai addressed them.
The 2 million jobs that we were promised has now turned out to be 2 million vendors. Yeah. Mugabe is no solution to the crisis because he's too tired. We are demanding a dignified exit for a tired Mugabe.
Tsvangirai noted, though, that he was not calling for the overthrow of the sitting government. Tsvangirai told his supporters that he was worried by the ruling party's failure to create the 2.2 million jobs that the president promised in the run-up to the 2013 national elections, adding that poverty was now rife in the country.
We are going to demand and take our rights to the people of Zimbabwe. Never again should we entrust our freedom in any particular individual.
MDCT Secretary General Douglas Monzora said his party was demanding an explanation to the missing $15 billion in diamond proceeds, noting that the protests would spread to other provinces in the next few days before a national mass action is announced.
This is just the beginning of the demonstrations we are going to have. We are going to have demonstrations in Bulawayo, Mutare, Mashingo, Gweru, Chinoy, and the other cities before we cascade to the growth points. But I want to commend the people of Zimbabwe for showing that they are responsible. This demonstration shows that Zimbabweans are able to have peaceful demonstrations.
Mr. Mugabe stunned the nation recently when he claimed that his government could not account for more than $15 billion in diamond sales generated from Manicaland province. As the opposition supporters marched in the streets of Harare, heavily armed police patrolled the streets and barricaded the road when protesters intended to march on parliament. The march proceeded after the High Court ordered the police not to stop the opposition from protesting. Reporting from Harare, this is Thomas Chiripasi.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Friday, April 15th. Please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 17 minutes past the hour, with just days to go before South Sudan first vice president-designate Riek Machar is due to arrive back in Juba. Disagreements linger between the government and the SPLMIO over how Machar will be welcomed back to the capital. Wake Simon Wudu reports for VOA from Juba.
SPLMIO spokesman William Ezekiel says his party's hopes are that their leader Riek Machar will still arrive in Juba next Monday, but says his group and the government have still not worked out the arrangements for Machar's reception. He says Machar wants to be sworn in as soon as he arrives.
These are concerns from our side, that he must take oath the day he arrives, the same day. That the state of emergency has to be lifted, must be lifted. And that even the transition should be verified by CITISAM.
CITISAM stands for the Ceasefire and Transitional Security Arrangements Monitoring Mechanism, the body charged with the monitoring security arrangements as per the peace agreement. Ezekiel says his party is not yet satisfied with the demilitarization of Juba as required by the peace agreement. According to the security arrangements under the peace deal, a sizable number of government troops should remain in Juba during the transitional period, while the remainder are to be redeployed 25 kilometers outside of Juba. Information Minister Michael Makwe insists the redeployment has been completed, but SPLMIO officials say that has not yet been confirmed by the CITISAM, and they want that confirmation before Machar arrives. Makwe told the South Sudan in Focus that it is not the responsibility of the SPLMIO to manage Machar's reception in Juba.
Should the first vice president designate arrive on Monday, he will be received at the official level at the airport, and after reception at the official level at the airport, he will proceed to his residence, where he will be receiving people, where he will be holding meetings. And the second day, that is day two, he will go to J1 to go and take oath of office. After the oath of office, he will proceed to his office.
Ezekiel says the SPLMIO's arrangements remain in place and there will be no compromise on those plans.
On our side, we oppose and we reject this idea for the leader to come, the first vice president designate to go, and again comes in the morning for a swearing in. This is unfair. And why should we make just one occasion, two occasions? Why should we want to waste resources more than we can do it just in a one day?
In addition, the SPLMIO expects Machar to address a rally upon his arrival, something the government has said will not happen. It remains to be seen whether Machar will arrive on Monday. For VOA News, I am Wake Simon Wudu in Juba.
The Bring Back Our Girls movement marched through Nigeria's capital on Thursday to mark the two-year anniversary of the kidnapping of the Chibok girls. A new video released on the eve of the anniversary purports to show 15 of the girls alive as recently as December and has raised hopes they still can be rescued. Chairman Mwankwo reports for VOA from Abuja.
Members of the Bring Back Our Girls movement gathered Thursday at Unity Fountain in Abuja amid a heavy police presence. It has been 2 years since Boko Haram grabbed 219 schoolgirls from their dormitory in northeastern Nigeria and herded them away into the night. Esther Yakubu is the mother of one of the missing girls. She visibly held back tears as she spoke.
It's only God. He's seen me through and he will see me through. And one day I know with him on that throne, they will be back. It's real. Because they have changed. Not the way they kidnapped them. 2 years ago, they are not like this. But today, they are 2 years on their other years. So they have changed. I recognize them. I know they are all girls.
About 300 marchers headed to State House, chanting the same call to action they have issued since they began these demonstrations almost 2 years ago.
What are we demanding?
We back our girls now and alive.
What are we asking?
The truth, nothing but the truth.
What do we want?
Our girls back now and alive.
Police blocked the gates to the State House. President Muhammadu Buhari is in China on an official visit. The group was not able to speak to a representative of his government. Founder of the Bring Back Our Girls movement, Obiageli Ezekwesili.
I am certain that our girls will be back. Our girls will be back. There is no evidence to the contrary.
Chibok community leader Huzaya Sambida said if their girls had been daughters of rich, influential Nigerians, the government would have done more.
We are here today to strike for the open nerves of humanity, to bring our conscience, to escalate our voices further, to speak for the voiceless Chibok girls and many like them still in captivity. That as long as they remain captives, humanity is in captivity.
Activists say the previous administration mishandled the kidnapping. The former first lady even questioned publicly whether the kidnapping had actually happened. But online, the Twitter hashtag Bring Back Our Girls trended globally, sparking international outrage. World leaders met in Paris a month after the girls were kidnapped to rally international resources to defeat Boko Haram. 2 years later, Boko Haram's now seven-year insurgency has killed 20,000 people and spread into three neighboring countries. When he took office in 2015, President Buhari said he would do everything in his power to find the girls, but said he could make no promises. Repeated attempts to negotiate with Boko Haram have failed. Nigerian and regional troops now say they have Boko Haram on the run, but none of the missing Chibok girls have been found. Chima Nwankwo for VOA News, Abuja.
World Bank President Jim Yong Kim said he's worried about the weak global economy and low oil prices. He also weighed in on the controversy surrounding the use of offshore accounts by some wealthy people, often to avoid paying taxes. Kim outlined his concerns ahead of high-level meetings of IMF World Bank officials this weekend. Mel Asega reports.
Global economic stability is a big concern for World Bank President Jim Yong Kim, citing weak growth around the globe, the decline in oil prices, and the influx of refugees pouring into Europe. Kim says demand for the World Bank services has never been higher.
We project that we'll provide more than $25 billion in loans this year to middle-income countries. That's $10 billion more than we had projected.
The new projection brings World Bank lending to more than $150 billion, the most during a non-crisis four-year period ever in the bank's history. The cost of rebuilding Syria alone could top $180 billion, says Kim. Worse yet, oil-producing member countries could face difficulties honoring global commitments, with oil prices well below the fiscal break-even point for some countries of between $80 to $90 a barrel. Economists we spoke with predict oil prices will stay at current levels for some time.
I don't think we'll get prices back down to the 20s the way we had at the end of last year, but the low 40s may be as high as we get for quite a while.
Adding to the World Bank's worries, new revelations by the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists of tax evasion on a massive scale. Kim says the bank is actively working with governments to recover state assets lost in secret offshore accounts.
for anyone who's involved in these kinds of activities. The message I'd send is transparency is not going to move backwards. The world is going to become only more and more transparent as we move forward. And so I would just say that be very careful.
Other issues likely to come up at the World Bank IMF meetings in Washington, the impact of a possible British exit from the Eurozone and growing anti-immigrant rhetoric in developed countries. Millar Sega, VOA News, Washington.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa. Sporting, here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Good Friday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak African Sports News, we begin with football. Africa under-23 champions Nigeria face Japan in their opening match in men's football action at the Rio de Janeiro Olympics in Manaus. According to the draws held in Rio de Janeiro on Thursday, Nigeria will later engage Sweden and Colombia in other Group B fixtures. Algeria will commence action against Honduras in Rio de Janeiro. They later encounter Argentina and Portugal. South Africa Challenge hosts Brazil in Brasilia. In the tournament opener, they play Denmark and Iraq in other Group A fixtures. Meanwhile, South Africa play Sweden at the start of their campaign in the women's football at the Olympics in Rio de Janeiro. They will play China and New Zealand in subsequent Group E matches. Zimbabwe play Germany in their maiden appearance in women's Olympic football action in Sao Paulo. Zimbabwe will also engage Canada and Australia in other Group F ties. Staying in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil will deliver a successful Olympics and have an outstanding legacy agenda, says the International Olympic Committee Coordination Committee head Nawal El Moutawakil. A Moroccan member of IOC, El Moutawakil delivered the verdict following a three-day inspection tour of facilities designated for the Olympics. In rugby, South Africa play Scotland before Kenya encounter Russia in Group C action at the IRB 7 series in Singapore. Singapore today, Friday. At the start of the eighth leg of this series, South Africa are third in the series standings with 122 points. Kenya is eighth with 63 points and Zimbabwe 17th with 1 point. In cricket, Rwanda play Sierra Leone in the ICC Africa Division 2 tournament in Johannesburg, South Africa, today, Friday. Mozambique is the other side in the three-way contest. The winner gets promoted to Division 1. Elsewhere, Namibia play hosts Nepal in the ICC World Cricket League Division 2 tie on Sunday. The three-day encounter will be played in the Nepalese capital, Kathmandu. Finally, in tennis, the ITF Confederation of Africa Tennis Under 14 East Africa Junior Circuit gets underway in the Kenyan capital Nairobi on Sunday. The week-long event has attracted boys and girls from 13 countries. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa, wishing you all a sporty weekend. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark, and have a good weekend. We look forward to your report again on Monday morning. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of news. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry is urging governments and industries to create enabling environments that spur connectivity while promoting a U.S. plan to bring 1.5 billion people who lack internet access online by 2020. That is it for this Friday, April 15th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post editor Mark Ouman, along with our engineer Jimmy Cook, I'm James Butte saying have a lovely weekend, Africa.
Next on Let's Talk, transportation in Africa. What are the common ways of transportation? Are they convenient? Join host Sandy Shomari and his guests discussing transportation in Africa. This lighthearted show covers topics of your interest. Let's Talk comes to you Mondays at 17:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa. Next time on Straight Talk Africa. We'll discuss the 2016 World Bank IMF Spring Meetings. Tune in to Straight Talk Africa next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.